Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Connolly, Judge Reyes, Judge Flory, the Honorable Francis J. Connolly presiding.
Thank you. Good morning. Our next case this morning is A21-0292, Mohammed Ahmed versus the Commissioner of Public Safety. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. Respondent will have 15 minutes, and finally, the appellant's counsel will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. When you're ready to get started, just please begin by identifying yourself in a loud, clear voice. This matter is being recorded in an audio fashion, so you will be able to listen to the recording sometime tomorrow when it's posted on the website. However, court rules specifically prohibit any private recordings of any kind by either the parties, their counsel, or private individuals who are guests. So please keep that in mind and comply with that rule. It is important. With that, counsel for the appellant, you may begin. And please just tell us who you are and allow your voice. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Dan Kohler, and I represent the appellant, Mohammed Ahmed, in this matter. By way of preparatory remarks, I apologize. My neighbor apparently hired a tree service this morning, and they are right outside my window. I'll be speaking louder and listening as carefully as I can, and I'm hoping nothing untoward happens during argument.
Well, let's hope your tree doesn't have any rot, and we can't hear a thing, so Mr. Good. Kohler, just please go ahead, and thank you for the heads up.
Thank you, Your Honor. Refusal by conduct cases can be far less straightforward than one where somebody actually says no. And legislatively and via the case law, there's two release valves, two safety valves for refusal by conduct cases. Statutorily, the person is given the choice between a blood and a urine test because we understand that's more intrusive than a breath test. We've also got case law establishing the right to cure a refusal. Both of those come into play here. What's not into play is the district court's factual finding that Mr. Ahmed constructively refused to submit to a urine test. That as a factual finding would be reviewed for an abuse of discretion. We're not challenging that determination today. Even if we don't like the fact that she treated that as a refusal, he was given over an hour and a half, hour and 45 minutes to provide that urine sample. The district court did not find that he refused to submit to a blood test. The district court said it was semantics as to whether he refused that or whether he simply expressed a preference for urine over blood. Our appeal is that it's not a matter of semantics. It actually does make a difference if he said no to the blood test or said yes to the urine test. And I believe the factual record establishes that that's what he did. He didn't say no to blood. He said yes to urine. In addition, the district court made no determination as to whether he cured any alleged refusal when he was repeatedly asking to submit to a blood test at the end. That would also be reviewed de novo by this court. But on the whole, the totality of the circumstances here, I do think that a revocation doesn't lie for refusal here because this is a lot like the Lausing case. It's been interpreted in unpublished decisions to narrow that holding, but
Mr. Kohler, before you go there, isn't this more like the Franco cat case? And that's a published, that's a precedential binding decision.
And it's a case that came prior to the Schultz case that does talk about the fact that refusals can be cured. And that type of safety valve does make sense because of the language in Schultz where they talk about the fact that, well, I really like the quote. It's well worded where the court said, well, I'm not going to find it and I'm not going to dig for it, but that this shouldn't be a gotcha. I mean, we want tests. That's why we have an implied consent law, is to obtain tests from drivers. And in this situation, there was no exigency involved. Obviously, the officer wants to get back on patrol, Well, we're not worried about loss of evidence in a case
this is, I agree with you. It's not an exigency case or anything along those lines. But what we have here is we have somebody who the officer allowed, well, first of all, he made a choice as to, at a minimum, he made a choice as to which test he wanted to take. He was offered the blood test and he said, I don't like blood. Can I take a urine test? So, and the officer said, okay, fine, you can take a urine test. But he took an hour and a half. He was given an hour and a half. And there's a, obviously the one of the potential charges is whether the blood alcohol concentration is over the legal limit within 2 hours. So he was given an hour and a half, and the officer even testified that something to the fact that it appeared to be he was just delaying. But under Franco, if you choose a particular test, you're bound by that choice. And once you make that decision, you're stuck with it. And the officer doesn't have to offer another test after your refusal. So that case seems to be right on point. Why isn't Franco controlling on that particular issue?
Because I think that conflicts with the language in Lausing, where the Supreme Court specifically said that it was the defendant's failure to accept the blood test after being unable to urinate that constituted the refusal. In Lausing, the refusal was the failure to submit to the alternate test after being unable to urinate. And so in that respect, I think that trumps Franco.
And well, but you have some problems with Lausing though, because first of all, the language there says that, quote, the officers acted properly when upon defendant's apparent inability to produce a urine sample, they then offered him the alternative of a blood or breath test. Saying officers acted properly doesn't mean that officers are required to do that. Second of all, that language in that case is Ditka. And we even later in a non-presidential opinion noted that that is dicta. I think there are some significant issues with that case. So and relying on that statement there, that's dicta.
And I'm in the unenviable position here today where I'm saying that was wrongly decided in an unprecedented decision because it's not dicta. My position is that the language after the language cited by the court, where the Lausing court specifically says that it was the defendant's failure to accept the blood test or the alternative breath test that constituted the refusal. So in Lausing, the refusal that was being penalized wasn't the refusal to the urine test. It wasn't the inability to pee. It was the refusal to accept the subsequent blood test, which I think changes the tone of the court saying, you know, the officer acted properly by offering an alternative test, because it is. It's even a little too strict for a remedial statute to say if somebody just absolutely can't go to the bathroom, bing bang, we got them. Especially in a situation like this, where the officer, it's not that Mr. Ahmed said no when the officer said, do you want to take a blood test? He begged for it. He begged for it for 5 minutes.
But he initially said he didn't like blood. So he declined the blood test initially.
And that's the argument that the court said was semantics. And if that's how this court rules, then I lose. But I think it is more than semantics. I think when somebody doesn't say no to both types of tests, it's a simple question. I mean, the officer can say, are you refusing the blood? Because in this situation, this would have been perfect. I mean, Mr. Ahmed didn't take an hour and 45 to provide a urine sample. The officer gave him an hour and 45 to supply a urine sample. And revocations for constructive refusal to urinate have been upheld under time periods far less than an hour and 45 minutes.
So let me ask you this, Mr. Kohler. He was offered a blood test, correct?
Correct.
And then he took a urine test instead, and then you're not contesting the fact that he refused it. It was a constructive refusal, correct?
We're not appealing the district court's determination. We're not saying she abused her discretion in finding
okay. that was a refusal. If that's the case, why doesn't the statute, Minnesota statute 171.177, subdivision 2, foreclose the relief you seek? Because there it says an action may be taken against a person who refuses to take a urine test, and he refused to take a urine test, constructive refusal. And then it says only if a blood test was offered. He had been offered a blood test. So why doesn't the statute apply and foreclose your argument right there?
Because of how this statute and prior statutes that are in substantial conformity have been interpreted. To avoid the, when I started my argument with saying we've got some relief valves in place for cases like this, I think that language has been read and should continue to be read in such a way where if somebody can't urinate, not if they say no, like in this case, I'm just saying like if it's a constructive refusal, like it makes sense under the implied consent law. It's a good practice. The officer should be commended for offering the alternative test. There was a warrant for both. And there's a reason why the warrant was for both. It was to give that option.
I think your language there is key though, Mr. Kohler, is it's a good practice for an officer to offer a blood test afterward. But I don't see any case law, and I don't read Lansing to require an officer to offer a blood test after a refusal for a urine test. And that position seems to be contrary to the plain language of the statute.
And my argument relies on a reading of that language in Lansing, where the court specifically found that it was the refusal of the blood test that was the refusal. Refusing the blood test was the refusal. It was the inability to urinate triggered the blood test that was subsequently refused. The equities of this case, I believe, are strongly in favor of Ahmed. It's how this statute, how the case law regarding immediate change of mind is interpreted by this court. And I think—
Well, that's a separate issue. I saw that as your second issue of whether or not he had an immediate change of mind. But don't we measure that immediate change of mind from the time that he was given the choice of either the blood or the urine test? That would seem to be the logical place to measure when he changed his mind. Because there he was offered the blood test. He said, I don't like blood. Can I do urine instead? So that's when he made the choice. Why isn't that the starting point for to determine when he changes mind?
And Your Honor, to come back around, like, I think that also goes straight to the semantics that the district court mentioned. If it's merely semantics that he elected one test over the other, that's one thing. I think the fact that he was immediately asking for it upon being deemed a refusal, like that's the point where the immediate change of mind kicks in.
Well, and let me just stop you right here. Just speaking for myself, I don't think it's just a matter of semantics. I think these words matter. I think the words in the statute matter, and how we describe them matter. Again, I'm just speaking for myself. So I think the words are extremely important. With all due respect to the district court, but what case law supports your interpretation that the immediate change of mind, the trigger for that is the refusal and not when he made the choice as to which test? Because it seems to me if he said, I don't like blood, can I do urine instead? And then immediately after that, he says, you know what, I changed my mind, let's just go with the blood test. That would seem to be immediate, not an hour and a half after the fact.
In my opinion, what it boils down to is your hypothetical seems to be saying an immediate change of mind as to which test to elect. My argument is still that he has the option at both if he's unable to provide a sample. Like, and I'll even narrow it down to I'm specifically addressing a situation where somebody's unable to urinate. But so I don't think the time period starts when somebody elects the test. This would, as far as I'm aware, there's no case law that directly says this. I'm relying primarily on cases that deal with breath tests where there is no second option. But all of the cases in support of our position would say that it's once the person is deemed a refusal. I mean, the situation could be he did elect blood, and then they were ready to stick him with a needle, and after the sixth or seventh stick, you know, it just didn't work. And he was like, no, stop. And then was like, well, no, whatever, keep going. Because well, and I see that I'm out of time, so I guess I'll save the rest for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kohler. We'll now hear for counsel for the respondent, please.
I'm ready, Your Honors. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Nicholas Moen. I'm here on behalf of the Commissioner of Public Safety, the respondent in this matter, to ask this court to uphold the ruling of the district court. I'd like to start, Your Honors, with this comment from opposing counsel that the district court ruled it was semantics which of the two tests he had elected. That is not what the district court said. If you look at A3, the third page of the district court's order, the court states, quote, it is a matter of semantics if petitioner refused or expressed a preference as petitioner was bound by that choice once made. Because there's no right to be reoffered a choice of tests, this petition fails, end quote. The semantics the district court was referring to was whether or not the appellant had actually initially refused a blood test or expressed a preference against a blood test. And that is because, as Judge Reyes pointed out, the appellant was bound by his choice of the urine test under the case law in Minnesota. That's why the district court was saying.
I'd like to explore that scenario. So I'd like to ask you this hypothetical. Let's say it's the exact same facts, and Mr. Ahmed says, give me a blood test. And then as he's being hooked up to draw blood, says, I've changed my mind. Give me a urine test. And that's, you know, let's say that's within 3 minutes, you know, of being hooked up. And as they're about to draw the blood, he says, you know what? I'm scared of, I'm whatever, but it's 3 minutes. Are you saying under those circumstances, he's still required to take the blood test under the case law?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. That in that specific factual situation, that could be construed as an immediate change of mind. The situation here, though, is very different because we don't have a matter of 3 minutes. We have a matter of close to 2 hours. And also during that 2 hours, the appellant was offered multiple glasses of water, which he consumed. And there is credible, unrebutted testimony.
Well, you know, I will just say, and maybe it's an age thing, Mr. Moen, but, you know, it's not always as easy to urinate as one would think, even if you do drink a glass of water, particularly if you're under a stressful situation, like I assume Mr. Ahmed was in a police station, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So, I understand the argument that one could make an inference that, you know, he's stalling, but I'm not so sure that's actually a correct inference. But anyway, go ahead.
Understood, Your Honor. I would then just move on to immediate change of mind in general. The appellant, whether or not he expressed merely a preference against blood or refused blood. He chose his test 2 hours prior to then stating that he wished to take a blood test. Nothing about this is an immediate change in mind. There is no case law in Minnesota that establishes a bright line under which you have to change your mind for it to be an immediate change of mind. But all of the cases address it in terms of a matter of a few minutes, not reaching the extreme length of close to 2 hours. His offer to take a blood test was not immediate in any sense of the word, and it did not cure his refusal by conduct to take a urine test, which appellant does not even contest. Urine tests and blood tests are clearly factually distinct from each other. They are also legally distinct. All of the case law and statutes in Minnesota imply, if not assert, that there is a distinct legal difference between a blood and a urine test. Under the statute, you have to be offered both before you can be considered a refused one. However, consenting to one of those tests does not mean that you have consented to both, nor does refusing one of those tests mean that have you refused both. So it would be very bizarre if you have all of that body of case law, and then in this one corner, the urine test and the blood test are identical to each other solely for the purpose of an immediate change of mind, so that in this case, the appellant immediately changed his mind after refusing the urine test. So in order to accept the appellant's argument that there was an immediate change of mind, not only would the point of decision not be when the choice of test was offered, but when the refusal occurred, but a urine test and a blood test would have to be determined to be legally the same thing. And that goes against all the body of case law and statutes in Minnesota.
Mr. Moen, I'm curious as to, I'm not sure I'm following you. When do we measure immediacy? From the time of the refusal of the urine test, or let's call it the time of the choice of the tests? And I assume your argument is from the time of the choice of the test, but why wouldn't it be measured from the time of the urine refusal?
Because the urine test is distinct from a blood test. Offering to take a blood test did not cure the appellant's refusal to take a urine test. The test that he chose, that he was bound by under the law in the state of Minnesota. The Franco case that you cited to Judge Reyes is applicable here. While this was decided before Schultz, it is still good law after Schultz. Schultz did not in any way overrule Franco. The appellant made his choice of test after he was offered both as required by the statute. He was bound by that test, and he refused it by conduct, which appellant does not concede or does not dispute. That offer to take a blood test at the end does not cure the urine test refusal. And it is 2 hours after having declined a blood test initially. And that is not an immediate change of mind, Your Honors.
I have another question, and it does go to the whole semantics issue. I think I expressed my opinion earlier with Mr. Kohler, but I do think it's important to determine what exactly happened, whether the blood test comment, was that a refusal or was that just expressing, was that declining or was that just expressing a preference, i.e. a choice? What is your position? Do you think that statement was a refusal? And I will just start out saying I'm not sure if that rises to the level of a refusal. He just said, you know, basically, I prefer not to give a blood sample. Can I take a urine test instead? That sounds more like, at most, declining the blood test, and more likely just expressing a preference for a urine test or choosing a urine test.
Your Honor, I think it is an open question as to whether that is a refusal or an election of the choice of urine. I do think it is the position of the commissioner that it was a refusal. However, it is ultimately not relevant in order to uphold the district court's determination, because as you pointed out, Judge Reyes, the language of the statute 171.177, it only requires that the appellant have been offered the choice of both tests. Nothing in that language of that statute or any legal authority that appellant can cite to requires that there be an explicit refusal of both tests before one can be considered to have refused one of them. They only have to be offered those tests. Appellant was offered both tests. He made his choice. He was bound by that choice, and he then refused that test through his conduct, which the appellant does not even contend. And I think the analysis can really end there, Your Honor. There is
precedent. Mr. Mullen, and that's following up on Judge Reyes's concerns, which I share. We can resolve this issue without dealing with the issue Judge Reyes is talking about. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And that is because you, under the statute, you only have to be offered both tests. You don't have to explicitly refuse both of those tests in order to be have considered to have refused one of them. He was offered both tests, which is all that's required under the statute. He made his choice. He refused that choice by his conduct, which is not contested by appellant. And under the case law in Minnesota, valid precedent, he was bound by that choice, and this revocation should be upheld. The decision of the district court should be upheld. That is all I have for now, Your Honors. I'd be happy to ask any further questions the panel has. If not, I would ask that this court uphold the decision of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Kohler, you'll have the last word, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Once again, may it please the court, opposing counsel. I do think it matters as to whether or not Mr. Ahmed initially refused the blood test or not. I do think that the statute is written in a way where it provides for somebody that's unable to provide a sample to have that second opportunity to take up the other test. I think it's silly to take the position of respondent on one narrow point where somebody could do an immediate change of mind for a urine test they were unable to provide. I want to point out that at the time Mr. Ahmed elected a urine test, he didn't know that it was going to be administered in a way that was extremely psychologically uncomfortable to him. He didn't have all that information at the time. I'm in a similar situation. I'd probably pick urine first, but if I couldn't provide a urine sample for being gun shy or whatever reason, like it's nonsensical and illogical, especially when you've got somebody all but begging to provide a sample, to not give them the opportunity to do so under the plain language of the statute. Now, and again, it's an entirely different case if the officer said, "Will you take a blood test?" and Ahmed said no, and then the officer wanted to cover his bases, follow the statute, and said, "All right, I can't charge you with refusal unless you also say no to urine. Will you take a urine?" And he's like, "Yeah, sure." And then it drags on for 2 hours. I think that fact pattern is legally distinguishable from the case here. I really do think it matters that Ahmed didn't say no to that blood test. And that's also why I think the immediate change of mind is something that needs to be analyzed at the point where Ahmed was deemed a refusal. Whether that happened after the officer gave him an hour and 45 minutes or after an hour, I've seen many cases where the officer has given somebody less than an hour and said, "Hey, if you can't do this soon, you're going to get charged with refusal. What about the blood test?" In cases where the person didn't already say no to blood. Well, and I've had cases where the person then did say, "I don't think I'm going to be able to do this," and provided a blood sample.
Well, Mr. Kohler, let me ask you this then. Would your argument be different if instead of the officer asking for a blood test first, as he did here, if the officer would have simply said, "Mr. Ahmed, I have a search warrant here for blood or urine. What do you want to take?" and he said, I don't really like needles, so let's do the urine. Would your argument be different here if the officer wouldn't have initially suggested a blood test here?
I think that's the same situation as here, where I don't think in this type of scenario, it's whichever one you pick out of the two, you're absolutely stuck with. I mean, logically, the language of the statute says that you can only take action if the other test was offered, but it's got to be more than that. Like, logically, it's not just that you offered it to them. They have to have also said no. Because if you...
But Mr. Kohler, can I stop you there? Where in the statute does it say only if a blood test was offered and the person refused? It sounds like you're reading language into the statute that is not there.
I wouldn't say reading into it, but let's just take it at face value. A person who refuses to take a urine test, I'm sorry, action may be taken against a person who refuses to take a urine test only if a blood test was offered. So let's say this situation was, the officer said, Mr. Ahmed, will you take a urine test? Yes. Tries, can't. And then the officer says, will you take a blood test? And Ahmed says, yes. And then the officer slaps the cuffs and walks him away. That comports with the statute because it was just offered. That's why I mean by reading into it. On its plain language, it's saying the officer just has to offer it. Doesn't have to let the person comply. But that's implied in the logic of the statute, is they have to actually be given the opportunity to comply with the request for the alternate test. And you can't do, well, arguably you can do blood and urine simultaneously, but that's not going to happen. You can only do one or the other at any given time. And so I do think it flies against the plain language and the logical reading of the statute to say the offer is enough. He actually does have to say no for the statute to make sense. And that's why we're asking this court to reverse the decision of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Moan. Thank you very much, Mr. Kohler. It's an interesting issue. We will issue our opinion within 90 days. So that concludes your case. We'll now move on to the next case that has been scheduled. Thank you.